judge. Mac had studied law and was adept at putting the authorities on the defensive. Fix, who was working toward a law degree, was a bright, resourceful fellow who had become the head of the prisoners' committee in our section. The job of our legal committee was to advise our comrades on how to conduct themselves in the island's administrative court. Von Rensburg was not a clever fellow, and while he would lord it over us at the quarry, we could outwit him in court. Our strategy was not to argue with him in the field, but to contest the charges in court, where we would have a chance to make our case before slightly more enlightened officers. In administrative court, the charge would be read by the presiding magistrate. "Malingering at the quarry," he might say, at which Von Rensburg would look smug. After the charge had been read in full, I always advised my colleagues to do one thing and one thing only. Ask the court for further particulars. This was one's right as a defendant, and though the request became a regular occurrence, Von Rensburg would almost always be stumped. Court would then have to be adjourned while Von Rensburg went out to gather further particulars. Von Rensburg was vindictive in large ways and small. When our lunch arrived at the quarry and we would sit down to eat, we now had a simple wooden table. Von Rensburg would inevitably choose that moment to urinate next to our food. I suppose we should have been grateful that he did not urinate directly on our food, but we lodged a protest against the practice anyway. One of the few ways prisoners can take revenge on warders is through humor, and Von Rensburg became the butt of many of our jokes. Among ourselves, we called him Suitcase. Warders' lunchboxes were known as suitcases, and normally a warder would designate a prisoner, usually his favorite, to carry his suitcase, and then reward him with half a sandwich. But we always refused to carry Von Rensburg's suitcase, hence the nickname. It was humiliating for a warder to carry his own lunch pail. One day, Wilton Mkwaye inadvertently referred to Suitcase within Van Rensburg's hearing. "Who is Suitcase?" Von Rensburg bellowed. Wilton paused for a moment and then blurted out, "It's you!" "Why do you call me Suitcase?" Von Rensburg asked. Wilton paused. "Come, man," Von Rensburg said, "because you carry your own suitcase," Wilton replied tentatively. "The general prisoners carry the suitcases of their warders, but we won't carry yours, so we call you Suitcase." Von Rensburg considered this for a moment and instead of getting angry announced, "My name is not Suitcase, it's Dicknake." There was silence for a moment, and then all of us burst into laughter. In Afrikaans, Dicknake literally means thick neck. It suggests someone who is stubborn and unyielding. Suitcase, I suspect, was too thick to know that he had been insulted. One day at the quarry, we resumed our discussion of whether or not the tiger was native to Africa. We were not able to talk as freely during Von Rensburg's tenure as we had been before, but we were able to talk nonetheless while we worked. The principal advocate of those who argued that the tiger was not native to Africa was Andrew Masando, an ANC leader from the Cape, who had also been a lecturer at Fort Hare. Masando could be a volatile fellow, and he was vehement in his assertions that no tigers had ever been found in Africa. The argument was going back and forth, and the men had put down their picks and shovels in the heat of the argument. This attracted the attention of the warders, and they shouted at us to get back to work. But we were so absorbed in the argument that we ignored the warders. A few of the lower-ranking warders ordered us to go back to work, but we paid them no attention. Finally, Suitcase marched over and bellowed at us in English, a language in which he was not expert. "You talk too much, but you work too few." The men now did not pick up their tools because they were bent over in laughter. Suitcase's grammatical mistake struck everyone as extremely comical, but Suitcase was not at all amused. He immediately sent for Major Kellerman, the commanding officer. Kellerman arrived on the scene a few minutes later to find us in much the same state as we had been before. Kellerman was relatively new to the island and was determined to set the right tone. One of the warders then reported to Kellerman that Andrew Masondo and I had not been working, and we were to be charged with malingering and insubordination. Under Kellerman's authority, we were then handcuffed and taken to isolation. From that point on, Suitcase seemed to hold a special grudge against me. One day, while he was supervising us at the quarry, I was working next to Fikele Bam. We were off by ourselves on the far side of the quarry. We worked diligently, but since we were both studying law at the time, we were discussing what we had read the night before. At the end of the day, Van Rensburg stood in front of us and said, "Fikele Bam and Nelson Mandela, I want to see you in front of the head of prison." We were brought before the lieutenant, who was the head of prison, and Van Rensburg announced, "These men did not work the whole day. I'm charging them for defying orders." The lieutenant asked if we had anything to say. "Lieutenant," I responded, "we dispute the charge. We have been working, and in fact we have evidence that we have been working, and it is essential to our defense." The lieutenant scoffed at this. "All you men work in the same area," he said. "How is it possible to have evidence?" I explained that Fix and I had been working apart from the others and that we could show exactly how much work we had done. Suitcase naively confirmed that we had been off by ourselves, and the lieutenant agreed to have a look. We drove back to the quarry. Once there, Fix and I walked to the area where we had been working. I pointed to the considerable pile of rocks and lime that we had built up and said, "There, that is what we have done today." Suitcase had never even bothered to examine our work and was rattled by the quantity of it. "No," he said to the lieutenant, "that is the result of a week's work." The lieutenant was skeptical. "All right then," he said to Suitcase, "show me the small pile that Mandela and Bam put together today." Suitcase had no reply, and the lieutenant did something I have rarely seen a superior officer do. He chastised his subordinate in the presence of prisoners. "You are telling lies," he said, and dismissed the charges on the spot. One morning in early 1967, during Suitcase's tenure, we were preparing to walk to the quarry when Suitcase informed us that an order had come down from Major Kellerman forbidding us to talk. Not only was conversation banned on our walks, henceforth there would be no conversation permitted at the quarry. "From now on, silence!" he yelled. This command was greeted by profound dismay and outrage. Talking and discussing issues were the only things that made the work at the quarry tolerable. Of course, we could not discuss it on the way to the quarry because we were ordered not to talk, but during our lunch break, the ANC leadership and the heads of the other political groups managed secretly to hash out a plan. While we were surreptitiously hatching our plan, Major Kellerman himself appeared and walked into our lunch shed. This was highly unusual. We had never had such a high-ranking visitor in our lowly shed. With a cough of embarrassment, he announced that his order had been a mistake and that we could resume talking at the quarry, just as long as we did it quietly. He then told us to carry on, and spun on his heel and was gone. We were glad the order was rescinded, but suspicious as to why. For the remainder of the day, we were not forced to work very hard. Suitcase did his best to be friendly and said that as a gesture of goodwill, he had decided to withdraw all pending charges against us. That afternoon, I discovered that my cell had been moved from number 4, near the entrance of the passageway, to number 18, at the back. All of my belongings had been dumped into the new cell. As always, there was no explanation. We guessed that we were to have a visitor, and I had been moved because the authorities did not want me to be the first among the prisoners to talk to whoever was coming. If each prisoner in turn voiced his complaints, the authorities could yell, "Time up," before a visitor reached cell 18. We resolved that in the interest of unity, each individual along the passageway would inform any visitor that while everyone had individual complaints, the prisoner in number 18 would speak for all. The following morning, after breakfast, we were informed by Suitcase that we would not be going to the quarry. Then Major Kellerman appeared to say that Mrs. Helen Suzman, the lone member of the Liberal Progressive Party in Parliament and the only voice of true opposition to the Nationalists in Parliament, would be arriving shortly. In less than 15 minutes, Mrs. Suzman, all 5 feet 2 inches of her, came through the door of our passageway, accompanied by General Stein, the commissioner of prisons. As she was introduced to each prisoner, she asked him whether or not he had any complaints. Each man replied the same way, "I have many complaints, but our spokesman is Mr. Nelson Mandela at the end of the corridor." To General Stein's dismay, Mrs. Suzman was soon at my cell. She firmly shook my hand and cordially introduced herself. Unlike judges and magistrates, who were automatically permitted access to prisons, members of Parliament had to request permission to visit a prison. Mrs. Suzman was one of the few, if not the only, members of Parliament who took an interest in the plight of political prisoners. Many stories were circulating about Robben Island, and Mrs. Suzman had come to investigate for herself. As this was Mrs. Suzman's first visit to Robben Island, I attempted to put her at ease. But she was remarkably confident and utterly unfazed by her surroundings, and proposed that we get down to business right away. General Stein and the commanding officer stood by her, but I did not mince words. I told her of our desire to have the food improved and equalized, and to have better clothing, the need for facilities for studying, our right to information such as newspapers, and many more things. I told her of the harshness of the warders, and mentioned von Rensburg in particular. I pointed out that he had a swastika tattooed on his forearm. Helen reacted like a lawyer. "Well, Mr. Mandela," she said, "we must not take that too far, because we don't know when it was made. Perhaps, for example, his parents had it tattooed on him." I assured her that was not the case. Normally, I would not complain about an individual warder. One learns in prison that it is better to fight for general principles than to battle each individual case. However callous a warder may be, he is usually just carrying out prison policy. But von Rensburg was in a class by himself, and we believed that if he were gone, it would make a disproportionate difference for all of us. Mrs. Suzman listened attentively, jotting down what I said in a small notebook, and promised to take these matters up with the Minister of Justice. She then made an inspection of our cells and talked a bit with some of the other men. It was an odd and wonderful sight to see this courageous woman peering into our cells and strolling around our courtyard. She was the first and only woman ever to grace our cells. Von Rensburg was exceedingly nervous during Mrs. Suzman's visit. According to Kathy, while Mrs. Suzman and I were talking, von Rensburg apologized for all his past actions. But his contrition did not last long, for the next day he informed us he was reinstating all the charges against us. We later learned that Mrs. Suzman had taken up our case in Parliament, and within a few weeks of her visit, suitcase was transferred off the island. Chapter 69. I never imagined the struggle would be either short or easy. The first few years on the island were difficult times, both for the organization outside and those of us in prison. After Rivonia, much of the movement's underground machinery had been destroyed. Our structures had been discovered and uprooted. Those who were not captured were scrambling to stay one step ahead of the enemy. Virtually every one of the ANC's senior leaders was either in jail or in exile. In the years after Rivonia, the ANC's external mission, formerly responsible for fundraising, diplomacy, and establishing a military training program, took up the reins of the organization as a whole. The external mission not only had to create an organization in exile, but had the even more formidable task of trying to revitalize the underground ANC inside South Africa. The state had grown stronger. The police had become more powerful, their methods more ruthless, their techniques more sophisticated. The South African Defense Force was expanding. The economy was stable, the white electorate untroubled. The South African government had powerful allies in Great Britain and the United States who were content to maintain the status quo. But elsewhere, the struggle against imperialism was on the march. In the middle to late 1960s, armed struggles were being fought throughout southern Africa. In Namibia, then Southwest Africa, Swapo, was making its first incursions in the Caprivi Strip. In Mozambique and Angola, the guerrilla movement was growing and spreading. In Zimbabwe, then Rhodesia, the battle against white minority rule was advancing. Ian Smith's white government was bolstered by the South African Defense Force, and the ANC regarded the battle in Zimbabwe as an extension of our struggle at home. In 1967, we learned that the ANC had forged an alliance with the Zimbabwe African People's Union, ZAPU, which had been formed by Joshua Nkomo. That year, a group of MK soldiers who had been training in Tanzania and Zambia crossed the Zambezi River into Rhodesia with the intention of making their way home. This first group of MK soldiers was christened the Lituli Detachment, and they were the spearhead of the armed struggle. In August, as the Lituli Detachment, accompanied by ZAPU troops, moved southward, they were spotted by the Rhodesian army. Over the next few weeks, fierce battles were fought, and both sides sustained casualties. Finally, our troops were overpowered by the superior numbers of the Rhodesian forces. Some were captured, and others retreated into Bechuanaland, which had become independent Botswana. By the beginning of 1968, another larger ANC detachment had entered Rhodesia and fought not only the Rhodesian army, but South African policemen who had been posted to Rhodesia. We heard of this months later by rumor, but did not learn the full story until some of the men who had fought there were imprisoned with us. Though our forces were not victorious, we quietly celebrated the fact that our MK cadres had engaged the enemy in combat on their own terms. It was a milestone in the struggle. Justice Penza, one of the commanders of the Lituli detachment, was later imprisoned with us. He briefed us on the detachment's military training, political education, and valor in the field. As a former commander-in-chief of MK, I was terribly proud of our soldiers. Before receiving the news of MK's battles abroad, we also learned of Chief Lituli's death at home in July 1967. The circumstances were curious. He had been hit by a train in an area near his farm where he often walked. I was granted permission to write a letter to his widow. Lituli's death left a great vacuum in the organization. The chief was a Nobel Prize winner, a distinguished internationally known figure, a man who commanded respect from both black and white. For these reasons, he was irreplaceable. Yet, in Oliver Tambo, who was acting president general of the ANC, the organization found a man who could fill the chief's shoes. Like Lituli, he was articulate yet not showy, confident but humble. He too epitomized Chief Lituli's precept, "Let your courage rise with danger." We organized a small memorial service for the chief in Section B and permitted everyone who wanted to speak to do so. It was a quiet, respectful service with only one sour note. When Neville Alexander of the Unity Movement rose to speak, it was apparent that he had come not to praise the chief, but to bury him. Without even perfunctory regrets at the man's passing, he accused Lituli of being a patsy of the white man, mainly on the grounds that the chief had accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. Apart from its wrong-headedness, Neville's speech was entirely contrary to the climate of cooperation between organizations we were trying to create on the island. From the moment I arrived on the island, I had made it my mission to seek some accommodation with our rivals in the struggle. I saw Robben Island as an opportunity to patch up the long and often bitter differences between the PAC and the ANC. If we could unite the two organizations on the island, that could set a precedent for uniting them in the liberation struggle as a whole. Yet from the beginning, relations with the PAC had been more competitive than cooperative. Some of the PAC men had already been on the island and saw our arrival as an encroachment on their territory. We heard from some of our men that the most senior PAC prisoners had expressed regret that we had not been hanged. In 1962, when I had first been on the island, the PAC had greatly outnumbered the ANC. In 1967, the numbers were reversed. Yet this seemed to harden the PAC in their positions. They were unashamedly anti-communist and anti-Indian. In the early years, I had talks with Zef Motopeng, who had been on the PAC's National Executive Committee. Zef argued that the PAC was more militant than the ANC, and that in prison the ANC should follow the PAC's lead. The PAC maintained that negotiations with the authorities were a betrayal, but that did not stop them from taking advantage of the benefits that resulted from negotiations. In 1967, I held talks with Selby Ngundane on the question of unity. Outside of prison, Ngundane had been violently opposed to the Freedom Charter, but in prison, particularly when sent to our section, Selby mellowed. We eventually wrote separate letters to our respective organizations in the general section advocating the idea of unity. The ANC also worked well with Clarence Makwetu, who later became president of the PAC. Makwetu, who had once been a member of the ANC Youth League, was in our section and was a balanced, sensible man. We had many fruitful discussions about the unity of our two organizations, but after Makwetu was released and was succeeded in the PAC leadership on Robben Island by John Pokela, the talks foundered. The PAC's insecurity occasionally had comical results. At one point, an order came from Pretoria that I was to be isolated from all other prisoners at the quarry. I would work separately, eat separately, and have my own guard. We noticed that this new ruling caused some agitation among the PAC. Several days later, the PAC decided that their leader, Zef Motopeng, would also be isolated, and on their own they had him work and eat separately from everyone else for as long as I did. The PAC often refused to participate in meetings that had no overt party affiliation. When we called meetings to discuss our grievances, and later had news sessions to discuss what we had learned from the paper, the PAC boycotted these gatherings. I found this greatly annoying. The PAC, we learned, were ignorant of changes in their own organization on the outside. At the time, the PAC members on the island refused to believe our claims that the exiled PAC had opened its doors to whites and Indians as members. That was heresy. Yet we had read in the paper that the white activist Patrick Duncan had become a member of the PAC executive. The PAC members derided this at the time as ANC propaganda. The ANC formed its own internal organization on the island, known as the High Command, or more officially, the High Organ. It consisted of the most senior ANC leaders on Robben Island, the men who had been members of the National Executive Committee, Walter Sisulu, Govan Mbeki, Raymond Mhlaba, and myself. I served as the head of the High Organ. From its inception, we decided the High Organ would not try to influence external ANC policy. We had no reliable way of evaluating the situation in the country, and concluded it would neither be fair nor wise for us to offer guidance on matters about which we were uninformed. Instead, we made decisions about such matters as prisoners' complaints, strikes, mail, food, all of the day-to-day concerns of prison life. We would, when possible, convene a general members' meeting, which we regarded as vital to the health of our organization. But as these meetings were extremely dangerous and thus infrequent, the High Organ would often take decisions that were then communicated to all the other members. The High Organ also operated a cell system, with each cell consisting of 3 members. In the first few years on the island, the High Organ also acted as a representative committee for all the political prisoners in our section. In 1967, we organized a petition demanding better treatment that was signed by virtually everyone, including members of the PAC, the Unity Movement, and the Liberal Party, represented by Eddie Daniels. This arrangement was acceptable to all until Neville Alexander complained that the High Organ was neither democratic nor truly representative, and that some other body ought to be created. Neville's original suggestion eventually turned into a prisoners' committee, composed of people from all political parties. There was fear among the other organizations that the ANC would attempt to dominate it, and the committee's rules were crafted so that its powers were purely consultative and its decisions not binding. Even so, it was still difficult to agree on a common approach to problems. We suggested that Fikele Bam, a member of the Yuchi Chan Club, preside over meetings. Later, the committee leadership would rotate. Eventually, the committee became known as Ulundi and acted as a disciplinary committee for all political prisoners. The high organ was the source of some controversy because of its ethnic composition. All four permanent members were from Xhosa backgrounds. This was a matter of coincidence rather than design. The senior ANC leadership on the island, the only four to have served on the National Executive Committee, happened to be Xhosa. It would not have been proper to take a less senior comrade and put him on the high organ simply because he was not a Xhosa. But the fact that the high organ was Xhosa-dominated disturbed me because it seemed to reinforce the mistaken perception that we were a Xhosa organization. I have always found this criticism to be vexing and based on both ignorance of ANC history and maliciousness. I would refute it by noting that the presidents of the ANC have been Zulus, Basutu, Pedis, and Tswanas, and the executive has always been a mixture of tribal groups. I recall once working in our courtyard on a sunny afternoon, while some men from the general section were working on the roof above me. They shouted at me, "Mdala, old man, why do you only talk to Xhosas?" The accusation stung me. I looked up and said, "How can you accuse me of discrimination? We are one people." They seemed satisfied by that, but their perception stuck in my mind. From then on, whenever I knew I would be walking in front of men from the general section, I would try to converse with Kathy or Eddie Daniels or someone who was not a Xhosa. We subsequently decided that there should be a fifth rotating member of the high organ. This member was usually not a Xhosa. Kathy, for example, was the fifth member of the high organ for more than 5 years. Lalu Chiba also served for a time, and in the end, the criticism died a slow and unremarkable death. I did not by any means dominate the high organ, and in fact, a number of proposals that I felt strongly about were rejected. This is as it should be, but I sometimes found it frustrating. There were two issues regarding the authorities about which I could never persuade my colleagues. Prison regulations stated that prisoners must stand in the presence of a senior officer. I advocated that we should remain seated, as it was demeaning to have to recognize the enemy when he did not recognize us as political prisoners. My comrades believed this was a trivial matter, and the negative consequences of resistance would outweigh any benefits. The second issue was rejected by the high organ on similar grounds. The warders called us by either our surnames or our Christian names. Each, I felt, was degrading, and I thought we should insist on the honorific Mr. I pressed for this for many years without success. Later, it even became a source of humor, as my colleagues would occasionally call me Mr. Mandela. Chapter 70. Time may seem to stand still for those of us in prison, but it did not halt for those outside. I was reminded of this when I was visited by my mother in the spring of 1968. I had not seen her since the end of the Rivonia trial. Change is gradual and incremental, and when one lives in the midst of one's family, one rarely notices differences in them. But when one doesn't see one's family for many years at a time, the transformation can be striking. My mother suddenly seemed very old. She had journeyed all the way from the Transkei, accompanied by my son Magatu, my daughter Makaziwe, and my sister Mabel. Because I had four visitors and they had come a great distance, the authorities extended the visiting time from a half an hour to 45 minutes. I had not seen my son and daughter since before the trial, and they had become adults in the interim, growing up without me. I looked at them with amazement and pride. But though they had grown up, I am afraid I still treated them more or less as the children they had been when I went to prison. They may have changed, but I hadn't. My mother had lost a great deal of weight, which concerned me. Her face appeared haggard. Only my sister Mabel seemed unchanged. While it was a great pleasure to see all of them and to discuss family issues, I was uneasy about my mother's health. I spoke with Magato and Maki about my desire for them both to pursue further schooling and asked Mabel about relatives in the Transkei. The time passed far too quickly. As with most visits, the greatest pleasure often lies in the recollection of it. But this time, I could not stop worrying about my mother. I feared that it would be the last time I would ever see her. Several weeks later, after returning from the quarry, I was told to go to the head office to collect a telegram. It was from Magato, informing me that my mother had died of a heart attack. I immediately made a request to the commanding officer to be permitted to attend her funeral in the Transkei, which he turned down. Mandela, he said, while I know you are a man of your word and would not try to escape, I cannot trust your own people, and we fear that they would try to kidnap you. It added to my grief that I was not able to bury my mother, which was my responsibility as her eldest child and only son. Over the next few months, I thought about her a great deal. Her life had been far from easy. I had been able to support her when I was practicing as an attorney, but once I went to prison, I was unable to help her. I had never been as attentive as I should have been. A mother's death causes a man to look back on and evaluate his own life. Her difficulties, her poverty made me question once again whether I had taken the right path. That was always the conundrum. Had I made the right choice in putting the people's welfare even before that of my own family? For a long time, my mother had not understood my commitment to the struggle. My family had not asked for or even wanted to be involved in the struggle, but my involvement penalized them. But I came back to the same answer. In South Africa, it is hard for a man to ignore the needs of the people even at the expense of his own family. I had made my choice, and in the end, she had supported it. But that did not lessen the sadness I felt at not being able to make her life more comfortable, or the pain of not being able to lay her to rest. In the early hours of the morning of May 12, 1969, the security police awakened Winnie at our home in Orlando and detained her without charge under the 1967 Terrorism Act, which gave the government unprecedented powers of arrest and detention without trial. The raid, I later learned, was part of a nationwide crackdown in which dozens of others were detained, including Winnie's sister. The police dragged Winnie away while Zini and Zinzi clung to her skirts. She was placed in solitary confinement in Pretoria, where she was denied bail and visitors. Over the next weeks and months, she was relentlessly and brutally interrogated. When Winnie was finally charged 6 months later, I managed to send instructions that she be represented by Joel Carlson, a longtime anti-apartheid lawyer. Winnie and 22 others were charged under the Suppression of Communism Act for attempting to revive the ANC. Later, George Bezos and Arthur Chaskelson, both members of the Rivonia team, joined the defense. In October, 17 months after her arrest, the state withdrew its case without explanation, and Winnie was released. Within 2 weeks, she was again banned and placed under house arrest. She immediately applied for permission to visit me and was rebuffed. There was nothing I found so agonizing in prison as the thought that Winnie was in prison too. I put a brave face on the situation, but inwardly I was deeply disturbed and worried. Nothing tested my inner equilibrium as much as the time that Winnie was in solitary confinement. Although I often urged others not to worry about what they could not control, I was unable to take my own advice. I had many sleepless nights. What were the authorities doing to my wife? How would she bear up? Who was looking after our daughters? Who would pay the bills? It is a form of mental torture to be constantly plagued by such questions and not have the means to answer them. Brigadier Ocomp allowed me to send letters to Winnie and relayed one or two from her. Normally, prisoners awaiting trial are not permitted mail, but Ocomp permitted it as a favor to me. I was grateful, but knew the authorities had not granted permission out of altruism. They were reading our letters, hoping to glean some information that would assist their case against Winnie. During this time, I experienced another grievous loss. One cold morning in July of 1969, 3 months after I learned of Winnie's incarceration, I was called to the main office on Robben Island and handed a telegram. It was from my youngest son, Magato, and it was only a sentence long. He informed me that his older brother, my first and oldest son, Madiba Tembikele, whom we called Tembi, had been killed in a motor car accident in the Transkei. Tembi was then 25 years old and the father of two small children. What can one say about such a tragedy? I was already overwrought about my wife. I was still grieving for my mother, and then to hear such news. I do not have words to express the sorrow or the loss I felt. It left a hole in my heart that can never be filled. I returned to my cell and lay on my bed. I do not know how long I stayed there, but I did not emerge for dinner. Some of the men looked in, but I said nothing. Finally, Walter came to me and knelt beside my bed, and I handed him the telegram. He said nothing, but only held my hand. I do not know how long he remained with me. There is nothing that one man can say to another at such a time. I asked permission of the authorities to attend my son's funeral. As a father, it was my responsibility to make sure that my son's spirit would rest peacefully. I told them they could send a security cordon with me and that I would give my word that I would return. Permission was denied. All I was permitted to do was write a letter to Tembi's mother, Evelyn, in which I did my best to comfort her and tell her that I shared her suffering. I thought back to one afternoon when Tembi was a boy and he came to visit me at a safe house in Cyrildene that I used for secret ANC work. Between my underground political work and legal cases, I had not been able to see him for some time. I surprised him at the house and found him wearing an old jacket of mine that came to his knees. He must have taken some comfort and pride in wearing his father's clothing, just as I once did with my own father's. When I had to say goodbye again, he stood up tall, as if he were already grown, and said, "I will look after the family while you are gone." Part 9. Robben Island. Beginning to Hope. Chapter 71. The graph of improvement in prison was never steady. Progress was halting and typically accompanied by setbacks. An advancement might take years to win and then be rescinded in a day. We would push the rock up the hill only to have it tumble down again. But conditions did improve. We had won a host of small battles that added up to a change in the atmosphere of the island. While we did not run the island, the authorities could not run it without us. And in the aftermath of von Rensburg's departure, our life became more tolerable. Within our first 3 years on the island, we were all given long trousers. By 1969, we received our own individual prison uniforms, instead of being issued a different set each week. These uniforms actually fit us, and we were allowed to wash them ourselves. We were permitted out in the courtyard at all hours during the weekend. Although our food was not yet equalized, African prisoners would occasionally receive bread in the morning. We were allowed to pool our food anyway, so that the differences did not matter. We had been given board games and cards, which we often played on Saturdays and Sundays. At the quarry, our talk was rarely interrupted. If the commanding officer was coming, the warders on duty would blow a whistle to warn us to pick up our tools. We had neutralized the worst warders and befriended the more reasonable ones, though the authorities realized this and rotated warders every few months. We were able to meet among ourselves virtually whenever we wanted. Meetings of the High Organ, general members' meetings, and meetings of Ulundi were generally not broken up unless they were too conspicuous. The inmates seemed to be running the prison, not the authorities. Stern and God-fearing, the Afrikaner takes his religion seriously. The one inflexible event on our weekly schedule was Sunday morning religious services. This was an observance the authorities considered mandatory. It was as if they believed their own mortal souls would be in peril if they did not give us the benefit of worship on Sunday. Every Sunday morning, a minister from a different denomination would preach to us. One Sunday, it would be an Anglican priest, the next a Dutch Reform pedicant, the next a Methodist minister. The clerics were recruited by the prison service, whose one edict was that they must preach exclusively on religious matters. Warders were present at all services, and if the minister strayed from religion, he was not invited back. During the first 2 years on the island, we were not even permitted to leave our cells for Sunday services. The minister would preach from the head of our corridor. By our 3rd year, services were held in the courtyard, which we preferred. In those years, this was the only time we were permitted in the courtyard on Sunday, except for our half-hour of exercise. Few of our men were religious, but no one minded long sermons. We enjoyed being outside. Once services were held outside, we were given the option of attending. Some men only attended services in their own denomination. Though I am a Methodist, I would attend each different religious service. One of our first ministers was an Anglican priest by the name of Father Hughes, a gruff, burly Welshman who had served as a chaplain in the submarine corps during the Second World War. When he first arrived, he was perturbed by having to preach in the corridor, which he found inimical to the contemplation of God. On his first visit, instead of preaching to us, he recited passages of Winston Churchill's wartime radio addresses in his beautiful baritone. "We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender." Father Hughes soon preached to us in the courtyard, and we found his sermons splendid. He made a point of discreetly inserting bits and pieces of news into his sermons, something we appreciated. He might say, for example, that like the Pharaoh of ancient Egypt, the Prime Minister of South Africa was raising an army. We always sang hymns at the end of services, and I think Father Hughes visited us so frequently just to hear us sing. He brought along a portable organ, and he would play for us. He praised our singing, saying that it was the only singing that matched the choirs in his native Wales. The Methodist minister was a Reverend Jones, a nervous and gloomy fellow who had been based in the Congo during its revolution. His experience there seemed to be the source of his melancholy. Over and over, he preached the importance of reconciliation, implying that it was we who needed to reconcile ourselves to the whites. One Sunday, during the Reverend's one-sided message, I noticed Eddie Daniels shifting uneasily. Finally, Eddie could take it no longer. "You're preaching reconciliation to the wrong people," Eddie called out. "We've been seeking reconciliation for the last 75 years. This was enough for Reverend Jones, and we never saw him again. Reverend Jones was not the only minister Eddie scared away. We were visited by a colored minister known as Brother September. One Sunday, a prisoner named Henny Ferris, who was an eloquent speaker, volunteered to lead a prayer. Brother September was pleased to recognize such devotion. Henny began speaking in lofty language and at one point asked the congregation to close its eyes and pray. Everyone, including Brother September, obliged. Eddie then tiptoed to the front, opened Brother September's briefcase, and removed the Sunday Times of that day. No one suspected anything at that time, but Brother September never brought newspapers again. Reverend André Scheffler was a minister of the Dutch Reformed Mission Church in Africa, a sister church of the Dutch Reformed Church, the faith of nearly all the Africana people. The mission church catered only to Africans. Reverend Scheffler was a crusty, conservative fellow who usually preached to the general prisoners. One Sunday, he wandered over to our section and we asked him why he didn't preach to us. "You men think you are freedom fighters," he said contemptuously. "You must have been drunk on liquor or high on daga, marijuana, when you were arrested. Freedom fighters, my foot!" But we challenged him to come to preach to us, and eventually, in the late 1960s, he responded. Reverend Scheffler was unorthodox in one respect. He took a scientific approach to religion. I found this very appealing. Many people use science to debunk religion, but Reverend Scheffler enlisted science to bolster his beliefs. I recall one sermon in which he talked about the three wise men from the east who followed a star until it led them to Bethlehem. "This is not just a superstition or a myth," he said, and then cited evidence from astronomers that at that time in history there was a comet that followed the path outlined in the Bible. As Reverend Scheffler became familiar with us, he became more sympathetic. He had a dry sense of humor and liked to poke fun at us. "You know," he would say, "the white man has a more difficult task than the black man in this country. Whenever there is a problem, we have to find a solution. But whenever you blacks have a problem, you have an excuse. You can simply say, 'Inga Belunga.'" We burst into laughter, not only because his pronunciation was unintentionally comical, but also because we were amused by the idea. "Ngabalungu" is a Xhosa expression that means, "It is the whites." He was saying that we could always blame all of our troubles on the white man. His message was that we must also look within ourselves and become responsible for our actions, sentiments with which I wholeheartedly agreed. What Sundays were to the rest of the week, Christmas was to the rest of the year. It was the one day when the authorities showed any goodwill toward men. We did not have to go to the quarry on Christmas Day, and we were permitted to purchase a small quantity of sweets. We did not have a traditional Christmas meal, but we were given an extra mug of coffee for supper. The authorities permitted us to organize a concert, hold competitions, and put on a play. The concert was the centerpiece. Our choir master was Selby Ngendane of the PAC. Selby had been a member of the ANC Youth League before switching allegiance to the Pan-Africanist Congress. He was a natural entertainer with a lovely voice and a fine ear. Selby chose the songs, arranged the harmonies, selected the soloists, and conducted the performance. The concert took place on Christmas morning in the courtyard. We would mix in traditional English Christmas songs with African ones, and include a few protest songs. The authorities did not seem to mind, or perhaps know the difference. The warders were our audience, and they enjoyed our singing as much as we did. Before coming to prison, Ngendane was perceived as something of a political lightweight. But in prison, Selby showed his mettle. In prison, one likes to be around men who have a sunny disposition, and Selby had one. Prison was a kind of crucible that tested a man's character. Some men, under the pressure of incarceration, showed true mettle, while others revealed themselves as less than what they had appeared to be. In addition to the concerts, we held a chess and draughts, or checkers, tournament, and also played Scrabble and Bridge. Every year I competed in the drafts competition, and some years I won the grand prize, which was usually a candy bar. My style of play was slow and deliberate, my strategy conservative. I carefully considered the ramifications of every option and took a long time between moves. I resist such analogies, but it is my preferred mode of operating not only in drafts, but in politics. Most of my opponents played more swiftly and often lost patience with my manner of play. One of my most frequent opponents was Don Davis, a member of the Non-European Unity Movement. Don had grown up in the diamond mining area of Kimberley and was a rugged, fearless fellow who was also highly strung. Don was an excellent draughts player, but his style contrasted with mine. When Don played, perspiration would flow down his face. He became tense and agitated as he played and made his moves rapidly as though points were awarded for speed. Several times Don and I found ourselves in the finals of the annual tournament. Don called me Kripu because of a habit I had when playing draughts. I would ponder each possibility, and then when I was about to move, I would call out Kripu, which means I strike, and then move the piece. Don found this frustrating, and he called me Kripu more in irritation than in amity. Don and I played in many tournaments, and even if he won, he would come back within a few minutes, challenging me to another match. Don always wanted to play draughts, and did not seem satisfied until I responded. Soon I was spending so much time playing with Don that my other pursuits languished. When I once failed to pass an exam in my studies, a few colleagues asked me why, and I responded to much laughter, "Don Davis!" Our amateur drama society made its yearly offering at Christmas. My thespian career, which had lain dormant since I played John Wilkes Booth while at Fort Hare, had a modest revival on Robben Island. Our productions were what might now be called minimalist, no stage, no scenery, no costumes. All we had were the words of the play. I only performed in a few dramas, but I had one memorable role, that of Creon, the king of Thebes, in Sophocles' Antigone. I had read some of the classic Greek plays in prison and found them enormously elevating. What I took out of them was that character was measured by facing up to difficult situations, and that a hero was a man who would not break even under the most trying circumstances. When Antigone was chosen as the play, I volunteered my services and was asked to play Creon, an elderly king fighting a civil war over the throne of his beloved city-state. At the outset of the play, Creon is sincere and patriotic, and there is wisdom in his early speeches when he suggests that experience is the foundation of leadership, and that obligations to the people take precedence over loyalty to an individual. Of course, you cannot know a man completely, his character, his principles, sense of judgment, not till he's shown his colors, ruling the people making laws. Experience, there's the test. But Creon deals with his enemies mercilessly. He has decreed that the body of Polynices, Antigone's brother, who had rebelled against the city, does not deserve a proper burial. Antigone rebels on the grounds that there is a higher law than that of the state. Creon will not listen to Antigone, nor does he listen to anyone but his own inner demons. His inflexibility and blindness ill become a leader, for a leader must temper justice with mercy. It was Antigone who symbolized our struggle. She was, in her own way, a freedom fighter, for she defied the law on the grounds that it was unjust. Chapter 72. Some of the warders began to engage us in conversation. I never initiated conversations with warders, but if they addressed a question to me, I tried to answer. It is easier to educate a man when he wants to learn. Usually these questions were posed with a kind of exasperation. "All right, Mandela, what is it you really want?" Or, "Look, you have a roof over your head and enough food. Why are you causing so much trouble?" I would then calmly explain our policies to the warders. I wanted to demystify the ANC for them, to peel away their prejudices. In 1969, a young warder arrived who seemed particularly eager to get to know me. I had heard rumors that our people on the outside were organizing an escape for me, and had infiltrated a warder onto the island who would assist me. Gradually, this fellow communicated to me that he was planning my escape. In bits and pieces, he explained the plan. One night, he would drug the warders on duty at the lighthouse to allow for the landing of a boat on the beach. He would furnish me with a key to get out of our section so that I could meet the boat. On the boat, I was to be equipped with underwater diving gear, which I would use to swim into the harbor at Cape Town. From Cape Town, I would be taken to a local airport and flown out of the country. I listened to the plan in its entirety and did not communicate to him how far-fetched and unreliable it sounded. I consulted with Walter, and we agreed that this fellow was not to be trusted. I never told him that I would not do it, but I never took any of the actions required to implement the plan. He must have gotten the message, for he was soon transferred off the island. As it turned out, my mistrust was justified, for we later learned that the warder was an agent of the Bureau of State Security, BOS, South Africa's secret intelligence agency. The plot was that I was to be successfully taken off the island, but killed in a dramatic shootout with security forces at the airport as I tried to leave the country. The entire plan had been dreamed up by BOS, even the rumors that reached me about the ANC's planning an escape. It was not the last time they would try to eliminate me. The term of a commanding officer was usually no more than 3 years, and we had been through several by 1970. That year, Robben Island's commanding officer was Colonel Van Aard, a rather amiable, harmless fellow who allowed us free rein. But at the end of the year, the authorities concluded that they wanted a different atmosphere on the island, and Colonel Pete Badenhorst was named the new CO of Robben Island. This was an ominous development. Badenhorst was reputed to be one of the most brutal and authoritarian officers in the entire prison service. His appointment indicated one thing. The government believed that discipline on the island was too lax and that a strong hand was needed to keep us in line. Badenhorst would supposedly make us yearn for the days of suitcase. Whenever a new commanding officer was appointed, I requested a meeting with him. I did this in order to impress upon him the seriousness of our cause and also to evaluate his character. I requested a meeting with Colonel Badenhorst and was turned down. He was the first commanding officer to spurn such a meeting. We felt the effects of his regime before we ever saw him. A number of the newer regulations regarding study and free time were immediately rescinded. It was obvious that he intended to roll back every privilege we had won over the years. Our old warders were transferred off the island and replaced by Badenhorst's hand-picked guards. They were younger, coarser men who enforced every niggling regulation, whose job was to harass and demoralize us. Within days of Badenhorst's appointment, our cells were raided and searched, books and papers were confiscated, meals were suspended without warning, and men were jostled on the way to the quarry. Badenhorst attempted to turn back the clock to the way the island was in the early 1960s. The answer to every question was always no. Prisoners who requested to see their lawyers were given solitary confinement instead. Complaints were completely ignored. Visits were cancelled without explanation. The food deteriorated. Censorship increased. About a week after Badenhorst arrived, we were working at the quarry one morning when, without introduction or fanfare, Badenhorst and his driver pulled up in the commander's car. He got out and surveyed us from a distance. We paused to look at our new commander. Badenhorst returned my glance and called out, "You must pull your finger out of your ass." I did not care for this expression at all, and without thinking, I started advancing toward Badenhorst. He was still a distance away, and before I got close, he had returned to his car and driven away. From his car, Badenhorst radioed a command to his staff, and within minutes a truck had arrived to transport us back to Section B. We were commanded to be silent in the truck, and when we arrived at the courtyard, we were ordered to stand at attention. Badenhorst appeared in front of us, pacing back and forth. He seemed incapable of uttering a sentence without including an oath or swear word. "Your mother is a Moor," was his favorite expression, Moor being a vulgar term for an intimate part of a woman's anatomy. In his guttural voice, he told us he was disgusted to have observed our laziness at the quarry. As a result, he said, he was arbitrarily dropping all of our classifications by one notch. Though we despised the classification system, most of the men had by that time risen to at least